and welcome to the World Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
I've waited 5 years to say this.
Hola!
5 years, really?
5 years to say something in Spanish, yes. Or maybe just a couple of weeks since we've been doing the World Cinema podcast, but...
Fair enough. I'm glad that we were able to fulfill that wish.
My dreams have come true. I can retire a happy man.
This is episode 4, and tonight we're going to be looking at Bulba, directed by Pedro
Almodovar. So, do you want a bit of behind-the-scenes stuff, Elwood?
Would be good, because this is obviously a director that I've been meaning to watch something by for years and years and years, and never been able to do it. Apparently because I can't pronounce it, so I've never been able to ask for it at the counter, and they've given me like Speed 2 instead.
Well, to be fair, I struggle with his name as well. So a couple of years ago, I did my little solo podcast on World Cinema. There's like 12 episodes of it. And the first episode I covered The Skin I Live In, a film by Pedro Almodovar. And I did it very differently. I think you've heard one of the two of the episodes. You know, I'm reading from basically a script I've written. And it's much shorter. And the only reason I worked from a script is because I could not say Pedro Almodovar. And I was like going, Almodovar. And every time I came across it, but now I can say it fine. But it took me, a 15-minute podcast took me about 3 hours to record because I could not say his name. But yes, so interestingly, although he's a very popular and famous modern Spanish director, I probably would say the most famous internationally Spanish director that's working in Spain, I only discovered his films properly 3 or 4 years ago. Obviously I was aware of them all. And, you know, they're always highly regarded, aren't they? And people talk about them. But
He's certainly one of those he's one of the few directors who's able to sort of write his own checks. I think there's a small group of directors who have that. You've got, like, Oliver Stone, you've got Martin Scorsese, Spielberg, obviously, James Cameron, and I would say, to an extent, Francis Ford Coppola. I think he spent a great portion of his later career just paying off Apocalypse Now.
Probably. So I think in Europe you get a few of these sort of, they're not really auteurs in the sense, but they can make the films, that they're not forced to make a film on Netflix or something like that, although he has done so. And they will have sort of people that they commonly work with in terms of assistants and directors of photography, or people that they always work with to do the music, and they'll have a cast of people that you'll find appear in many of the films. But I'd heard of him and was aware of him. I may have seen a film or two, but not really understood that's what I was watching. But my youngest daughter was doing Spanish as a GCSE, and they used this film, actually, Volver, to as a film to watch to help with their Spanish. And so we bought this box set of Almodovar films to sort of watch together to help her with her Spanish. You know, I can't speak Spanish, by the way, so subtitles were on, but it's just to hear it. But yeah, and I got into it. So he's just really interesting because he makes films that are kind of lots of cross genres, and sometimes films will have different genres within the films, so it reminds me a lot of like Korean cinema in some ways. And the films all have a high on melodrama and quite high on camp quite often, but they've also got these incredibly labyrinthine plots that are going on. Not all the films are like this, but we could point at top 5 or 6 films and we would say they were like that. And so sometimes I wonder if getting into Almodovar as a director can be hard. What's the starting point? What's the best film to say? You know, do you go for Women on the Edge of a Nervous Breakdown? Do you go for, I don't know, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down? Do you go for, All About My Mother? They would be the sort of the classic ones. But I think Volver is probably a really good example because it hits the melodrama, it hits the sort of the plot, it hits the family with a dark secret that it becomes uncovered. It's got all the colour and it's all about women. For a gay man, Almodovar is obsessed by women, and you'll find that there's really strong female characters, which I hope you found in this film. Well, obviously I don't know how you felt about it, but I thought it was a good starter because I thought it just ticked all the Almodovar boxes without being too extreme in any particular way. And it also doesn't have, I've got to say, he is occasionally guilty of stuff which doesn't quite work, which I know puts some people off some films, but I think this one doesn't have any of those particularly why is he doing that moments. When you become a fan of it, you just laugh along with them, but I think it can be quite off-putting if it was the first one you saw. So anyway, how, just generally, before we go into the plot, how did you feel about it?
She very much enjoyed this one. As I said, he's a director I've always had name recognition with, but at the same time, I've never got round to watching any of his work until obviously tonight, which is obviously goes sort of hand in hand with the objective of the doing this bonus show and the fact that he gives us a chance, an excuse to cross off stuff off our watch list, look at directors we otherwise wouldn't get round to watching because, you know, we're just off being distracted by shinier things. So by having, sometimes you just need the job that a podcast like this provides you with to obviously cross these things off your list. So as a first-time introduction to the world of Almodovar, I thought it was a very interesting film to look at. And at the same time, it hits many sort of areas that other films I feel sort of failed to hit, as well as we get into when we sort of get into the plot of this film. But if anything, it features an incredible stand-up performance by Penelope Cruz, who had a brief sort of dalliance with the Hollywood system when she was flirting around with Tom Cruise. And
yeah, I mean, I guess she sort of Captain Corelli's mandolin, and was she in Vanilla Sky? Which was a remake of a Spanish film she was in the original of, which is, well, they're the same story, different films. But yes, I don't think her Hollywood career, I don't think it was terrible, but she's had Oscar nominations. I think she got an Oscar nom, didn't she? I'd say she can be like this entry point, you know, oh, I recognize Penelope Cruz, and actually, my God, she's a really good actress, isn't she? Which I don't think, if you just watch some of her English language stuff, you'd necessarily have got.
No, and I mean, it's actually pretty extensive, the work that she did in the Hollywood system. I mean, when you look at it, and there's some really great titles in here, such as like Murder on the Orient Express, The Counselor, Vanilla Sky, which you mentioned already, and Sahara, which I enjoyed and wish that they'd actually done more with. I think it could have been like a really interesting franchise of movies that they could have obviously made out of it, you know, especially because it's based on the Clive Cussler books, and which are themselves all the very sort of Indiana Jones-esque sort of tales. And I think that with the whole setup there, I think it was had some real sort of interesting potential, especially for Matthew McConaughey to really have gone and done something with it. But sadly, we weren't really in a franchise place back in 2005. You know, the Marvel movies, and well, basically we entered into this period where, you know, anything that can be turned into a franchise or a multiverse, studios were wanting to get behind. So. But it's interesting to say, it's always interesting to go back and see some of her native work. And obviously she is a regular within a Almodovar's world, really. I mean, she did like Live Flesh, All About My Mother, and obviously this film. So.
And very recently, Parallel Mothers, which is the thing he did for Netflix, which is fucking good as well. And actually feels like this film. It does feel like a sort of a natural successor to Velvet. But I just think she's just, you know, just sometimes these actresses from other countries come in, and I feel sometimes they're just used a bit as eye candy, but there's way more to her than that, which hopefully this film gave you. Fake bum and all.
film itself sees Cruise starring as Ramunda, a working class woman who's forced to go to great lengths to protect her 14-year-old daughter Paula after she murders her father. Meanwhile, the family, in which includes her sister and ghost mother, come together over the course of the film as they work out their individual problems. The plot of the film originates from Almodovar's earlier film, The Flower of My Secret, from 1995, where it features a novel that's rejected for publication only to be stolen to form the screenplay of a film named The Freezer. The film itself draws inspiration from Italian neorealism of the late 1940s through to the 1950s and takes in the work of pioneering directors such as like Fellini, Visconti, and Pantaloni, with the film tying in the themes such as sexual abuse, loneliness, and death, while also mixing in the genres of farce, tragedy, melodrama, and magical realism, while also being set in the region of La Mancha, which is where Almodovar is from. And I have to say, it's quite the image he paints of his hometown. It's this windswept location where wildfires threaten to constantly burn everything down, and where women are greatly outnumbering the men, mainly because the men all seem to die before their wives do. So the wives are left to constantly tend to their gravestones. And we have this wonderful opening shot of the women of this town, like, dusting off gravestones, and one of these women who's actually tending to her own gravesite, and she likes to prep it, and they remark that she's treating her gravesite like a second home.
Yeah, so they make out it's some kind of tradition. I don't know how much of it is true or some kind of sort of pastoral imagery that Almodovar's trying to create for his tone. But it's interesting because quite often, you know, a lot of his films are set in Madrid. So La Mancha is like a rural area. Is it south of Madrid? I think. I don't know. It's not that far. But yes, you quite often his things are set in the city. So it's really nice to see part of this film, at least, is set back in their sort of home village where they've gone to, like you say, they're going to take part in some, almost like one of these Asian festivals of the dead, isn't it? Where they, you know, we see so often in our other show where people are spending a day cleaning out their ancestors' resting places. So it's a bit like that. And they go and check in on their... So yeah, so we find out via chit-chat that their parents died in a fire. And they go and check in on their aunt, who's clearly suffering from Alzheimer's, and but there's
Aunt Paula, who's played by Shours Lamprieve, who is for my money the greatest character in this film, if only for the fact she wears these giant jam jar bottle glasses that just like cause her eyes to like magnify to this incredible extent. It's like she's like a living cartoon character. This aunt who's sort of like, she's old and she's got dementia, and she's like constantly remarks that their mother is there helping her, and they're like, oh, of course she is.
Which of course is, I mean, the film is not subtle about what the twist is going to be. If you don't get the twist that's going to happen, it's not going to, because there's no way this woman could look after herself, is there? And then there's the neighbour that you've already mentioned, that sort of does look in on Aunt Paula as well. But she's got a sister who is a sort of works in Madrid on some trashy TV show, like a Maury Povich or a Jerry Springer type show that she runs in there, but they don't seem to have a lot in common. But they're sort of one of those sort of background items that comes up as a little subplot later on, but for no good reason, really. And I think the important thing is every character we mention are all women. I think there's two male characters with any kind of lines in this movie. I can't think of more than the guy that runs the restaurant and the guy that comes in and does it. And obviously the Paula's father, who is killed two scenes in, and you know, he barely says anything. So this is all about women, this film, and their relationships, whether they're sisters, neighbours, mothers, aunts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting, as you mentioned, right? The two male figures are in this film. One who's just a voice on the end of the phone line. All the male characters are really there just to serve as plot devices. They're there to further the story than actually be actual players within this story. I mean, you mentioned already Paula's father, or Amanda's husband, Paco, who's this lazy bum of a drunk who ends up being stabbed by his daughter after he attempts to rape her. In a scene that's you see the aftermath, frankly, because something we've encountered a lot recently. We've encountered a lot of like sexual assault in the films we've been covering. So it was kind of nice to not have to do another film dealing with that. So
and of course, you know, semi spoilers. There is another male character who we never meet who has also done something quite terrible. You know, the center of this, as there always is with a Almodovar film, there's a horrible secret, family secret, and what's Penelope Cruz's character called again?
Ramunda.
Yeah, I mean, her father turns out was a nasty piece of work, and everything ties together. But yes, the male characters are either ciphers or they're horrible. That's the worse than horrible, sort of evil, even. And just, I just always found this fascinating. All Almodovar's films have got incredibly strong female characters, and you think, as I said, as a out gay man, I just find it amazing that he is so obsessed about that. Obviously, he's got plenty of films with Antonio Banderas in as well, so there's very rarely no male characters, but this is a very unusual one that's the case.
No, and I think it makes it all the more interesting here that we have a film which is essentially dealing with the interactions between three generations of women within the same family. Obviously, heading up things, we've got Ramunda, as we mentioned already, here with Penelope Cruz, who's the most glamorous character in the film. Every time she's on the screen, you end up doing like a double take. It's like when you see Annabelle Wong, like in like the original FIFA Bad Dad. It's all like you end up doing this double take when she's on the screen. And her sister Sole, runs an illegal hairdressing operation out of her apartment.
I like that.
I'm not sure why it's illegal, but.
Well, it's probably because it's been run out of her living room without any, well, it's because it's been run out of her living room without any sort of, she's probably not paying tax. She's probably not got any insurance. Yeah. But yes, she's basically a mobile hairdresser who works from her living room.
Yeah. So, obviously we've just got a daughter, Paula, and we have the ghost mother, so we have these generational characters, and the film, as I said, it's very minimalistic in its plot. There's no real sort of like big. We obviously have this one big plot where obviously Ramunda is attempting to cover up the fact that her husband has been murdered, which itself is shot with no threat. There's no real issues that it provides. It's more just an inconvenience.
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was going to use. There's an inconvenient dead body that she just says, oh, we've split up, he's gone away. No one really questions it.
Police don't even investigate it.
No, and there's a couple little side issues where, side stories, you know, where she gets, there's a prostitute that lives in her apartment block that helps her get rid of the body eventually in a swamp or something, but that's just a little 5 minute side plot. I think he's kept in a fridge downstairs at the restaurant for a little bit, and it's just mentioned. Bob, we don't ever see him again, I don't think, in any way, shape or form. It's just there because you're right, the real story, that there's no great overarching plot. It is just about their mother, who I'm going to spoil it, mate, because I think it's fair. I don't think we can talk about her. You could call her the ghost mother. So they think their mother is dead. And the mother basically faked her death. There's some other things that come out of that. We won't go through it all. But her mother has faked her death and has been living with Aunt Paula. And that's how they've been looking after. But she sort of... When Aunt Paula dies at the end of the first act, basically mother announces herself to Soleil and moves in with Soleil. I think Soleil really does think she's a ghost for a bit, though, doesn't she?
it's very weird, yeah. The fact that... She originally presents herself as being a ghost, and then other characters will sort of just discover it and immediately accept the fact that she's alive. But
I've just remembered. But Soleil says that they decide that she's a Russian immigrant.
Oh yeah, to disguise her identity.
What should I be? Shall I be? Oh, she comes up with some nationalities which she could never be. Like, shall I be Jamaican or something? She says, or Barbadian or something. No. Let's be Russian. But they're hiding her from Penelope Cruz's character because it is quite clear that. Well, what it turns out is that there's some reason they didn't get on, and they didn't even live together. So. Soleil lived with her mother, and did Penelope Cruz's character live with the father? Oh no, she lived with Aunt Paula. That's right. So there's this whole thing that they didn't live together. They didn't grow up together. We don't really find out why, but the story is basically about this mother and daughter combination sort of connecting again.
Yeah, the closest we get to like a big, well, there's two big plot points in this. We have Ramunda, who finds a purpose for herself when she takes over the restaurant where she's hiding her husband's body, because there's a film crew in town. They're looking for somewhere to provide the catering, so she finds herself drawn back into the restaurant business and manages to make it a success while doing deals with other women in the area. She's like Boris. Bits and pieces, such as like she borrows chocolates from one woman, and she
the big leg of pork and chorizo. Oh, she meets somebody in the street. Oh, I've just got some chorizo from this special region. Oh, can I buy that off you? Yes, okay. it's fine.
You have all these women in the town who are just like willing to help each other, and she does all these deals, and she manages to turn this restaurant into a success by catering for this film crew are working down the road. And the other plot point is this fractured relationship she had with her mother, because when she was a small child, she was always like, her mother described as being like the apple of her eye. They had this really great relationship. And from her mother's viewpoint, when she became a teenager, she became very distant and went to live with the aunt. And it was never really revealed what caused the relationship to become so fractured. And over the course of the film, they work out the differences and they find out what it was that caused them to initially sort of drift apart, and generally can be just boiled down to problematic men.
And it kind of explains why Paco, the layabout husband, acted the way to Paola he did. I mean, it's still unforgivable, but it's a little less icky than it appeared to start with, but again, we just don't, until the final truth is uncovered, lots of people's motivations are just weird. it's until we find out what's happened. But yeah, it's a melodrama. Yeah, that's what it is, with this sort of bits of comedy elements about getting rid of a dead body. But yeah, it's not as elaborate. Say something like, I think it's Bad Education, another Almodovar film I'd recommend. And Bad Education has got this. It's basically a sort of a criticism of the Catholic Church and the abusive priests and stuff like that. But that has got like this big sort of, the structure of the film is really complicated, and there are twists and flashbacks and whilst it's got a similar feel to this, it's more complicated in its structure. Well, this is fairly A to B, right? There's no real flashbacks or anything that I can remember. Yeah, now you're going to tell me this is huge flashbacks, but I felt it was just fairly simple, isn't it, in terms of its execution.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the film itself is very sort of straightforward, and it's more just the uniqueness is really in just in the relationships that these characters have with each other. As I said, it's a town seemingly just populated by predominantly women, which, as I said, we can sort of like tie back into that opening scene where they just say how like the women in the town tend to outlive all the men.
Yeah.
Although who the prostitute is doing trade with, it's not too sure, but...
But she has to go to the town centre, doesn't she? There's obviously no men in the area they're living in. That's because she gets... Soleil has to give her a lift, doesn't she? As they return home from their little village back to... I think they go back to Madrid, don't they? Is it Madrid? Well, it's close by, wherever it is. And she's the prostitute is leaving the apartment block, and... Penelope Cruz just says, oh, Sola, you'll give her a lift, won't you, to where she needs to be. And that's very clear. Paola knows what she's doing. It's, I think it's lovely. It's just so matter of fact, but you're right. Who is paying for sex with her? But that's why she's probably always available to help out all the time.
I don't remember the name of the test where you have two female characters who have a
Bechdel. So the Bechdel test, which is you've got to have female characters having a conversation that's not about a man.
I think this is one of those rare occasions where we have a film which actually passes that test
because with flying colours. Because even when they do talk about men, it's not in a sense of a... It's about a familial link. It's never about, you know, oh, I really love this man. What am I going to do? Which is often the thing that makes films fail. So yeah, this absolutely obeys that.
And even when you like look at it even sort of like more, I mean, I kept waiting for like the obvious romantic angle to come up. As soon as we had like the film crew turn up. And you've got like one of the gophers from the film crew turns up and he starts like, just he's like, oh, would you be able to do the catering? I thought, oh, here we are. We've got the handsome film guy and he's going to get involved with Ramonda. But no, it doesn't happen that way. The only thing that it really serves to do is just to sort of like provide this way for Penelope Cruz to go, for Ramonda to do some singing. Which is more to tie her back to a connection with her mother, because when she was a child, that her mother used to put her out into like talent contests and sort of did singing with her. So it was like it's more about forming that connection there. So it is really interesting when you look at it, and it's all like whenever a male character's mentioned or has an interaction there, they're just plot devices. It's sort of like, or they are an excuse for a character to be somewhere else, such as like when Ramonda has to go and bury the refrigerator, which is bizarre. They bury a whole refrigerator. They don't just take the body out of the refrigerator.
Were you having flashbacks to those public information films that don't get in a refrigerator by the river?
No, it's sort of like, it just seemed like she, I mean, I understand she stores the body in the refrigerator because she does a bit of reverse fridging. So we might as well have all the tests tonight. Might as well.
Yeah, that's to get the old comic book test, isn't it? Women in refrigerators. So, yes.
Yeah, fridging is. Obviously in this film, and you know, Paco spends the majority of the film in the refrigerator. So you would have thought that, because we see her going to the DIY store and she's like buying the plastic wrap and the twine and all the rest of this, and it's all like, oh, she's gonna take him out and rip him up, but no, it's not the case. Still, they bury the whole refrigerator, which is just like bizarre. I mean,
that's another lovely scene with a man in again, as you said, you remember, but it's she goes like this hardware store, and it's like it just reminded me of the Four Candles, Ronnie Corbett and Ronnie Barker sketch, because she just goes, I want, I don't know, 6 foot of twine, some 6 rolls of duct tape. And the guy, I mean, it's clear what she's doing, right? She's just Oh, she asks for all that tarpaulin, doesn't she? I mean, it's just, it's like, what's the Danny Boyle film where they get rid of a body? Shallow Grave. It just
oh, yeah.
It just reminded me of 50 other, and the guy, the sort of the Ronnie Barker type who's working in this ironmongery shop. And there's a word that we don't use anymore. Ironmongery.
Ironmongers.
Yeah. He clearly you just see it dawn in his eyes what she's doing, but there's never any, okay, well, there we go. Would you like this to go? It's just lovely scene.
It's also really bizarre to see Penelope Cruz driving a van.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we get it. She's like, you know, she's a pretty one, which means we get to see her shots of her being pretty in the kitchen and get to see her singing, which is also very nice. And then you see Penelope Cruz like driving the transit van. It's all like, oh wow, she's a woman of many talents, clearly.
Well, she's incredibly independent. That's the point. Because there is this thing that she is an incredibly attractive woman. She is very curvaceous. And I joked about it before, but you do know that she is wearing a fake bum. Because
I know this is where something true, but it's not really noticeable that she's wearing
a fake bum. Well, it's not unless you've seen her in other things. Because she is a... She is very... mammarily blessed, but she's a very skinny lady, and so Moldovar wanted her to look like the women from La Mancha, and he said, but they've all got big bums as well. So yeah, she's got this fake posterior on, but like you say, it's not ridiculously over enhanced or anything. It's, you would notice it more if you'd seen her in other films.
Do you think we would have noticed it more had like Kim Kardashian not took it to the utmost extreme?
Well, so they might. I think there is absolutely a bit of that.
I think the new standard now, when we look at like J-Lo and Beyonce and Kim Kardashian, because they've got such extreme posteriors, that the subtle extreme posterior that we have in this film is not really so noticeable.
Yeah, this isn't like watching Nicki Minaj. No, this is anything like that. But yeah, and to be honest with you, if I hadn't read it, I wouldn't have known. But once I knew, it was obvious that it's that kind of thing. But this is, again, it's about Almodovar having this. And I've got to say, you mentioned that scene where you see her, there's an overhead shot and she's like doing the washing up. I think is she not cleaning maybe the murder weapon that Paola's killed him with? But you're clearly looking down her cleavage, and she's doing a sort of what would be a mundane sort of washing up type task, but she's also got this bloody knife and then there's her crucifix is like resting in her cleavage, and it's really deliberately shot. And if this was any other director, say this was who's the fella that does the Transformers movies?
Michael Bay.
If this was a Michael Bay shot, it would be about fetishizing Penelope Cruz's breasts, right? Because this is a Pedro Almodovar film, it's doing a million and one other things. It's kind of doing that as well, but not in a pervy, leery way. It's just showing that she's a woman. It's just brilliant.
I'm sure. The fact is that I love this, like, idea that, you know, gay men have no interest in boobs. Yes, gay men have interest in boobs. That's why they're constantly groping up their female friends. They just can't get away with it.
Oh, I'm going to let you stand on that hill alone, mate.
I'm just sad to say, as someone who spent a large amount of time, you know, working in the village, I know exactly what the bloody game is. So yes, I know while obviously your interests lie in your same gender, but it does not mean that you cannot appreciate boobs as well, or bums, or whatever.
Oh, I think absolutely.
The human form can be appreciated in ways other than the... You know, what gets you feeling like you're climbing the gym ropes.
And Almodovar certainly knows that with his muse here, with Penelope Cruz, he can certainly display her sexuality. Although she is not a sexual character, right?
You know, there is no... They present her as... What's the word? I don't want to say muddy her up. They don't... they don't take away from her natural beauty, but at the same time, they don't make it the focus of her character.
No.
She's a hard-working single mother.
Yeah, she's a glamorous, yummy mummy, right? That's what she is.
That's exactly what she is, isn't it?
Yeah. But and the prostitute is a late middle-aged woman that you wouldn't look at twice, I certainly wouldn't. And so they're playing with the convention, and she doesn't fall in love with the sexy young guy that works on the film crew, and there are no comic things where there's some character that obviously lusting after her, but she is clearly a sexy young lady. Where's this? 2006. So she's what, in her early 30s? Yeah, that makes sense, because Paola's meant to be 14. Yeah, so it's probably playing actually a bit. She's probably a bit older than the character she's playing. She's lovely, but not dead. But that's not important for her character. Her character's trying to make ends meet, trying to protect her daughter, trying to get rid of a dead body, trying to process quite a dark secret which she's having to live with her entire life. It's complex, but it's nice.
It's interesting, really, that when you look at when this film came out, it was sort of like the darling of publications like Empire, much the same way that Last Caution was, and also much like Last Caution, it sort of like disappeared as soon as it sort of like exploded into our conscious. Even though it is featured, like both films are featured in the 1001 Movies to See Before You Die book, which I don't know if you... Do you own a copy of 1001 Movies to See Before You Die? I think it's all like one of those books we all seem to have on our shelf.
I don't, actually, but I have bought it for at least three different people as Christmas presents.
So it's the people who try to to defeat the list, though, normally find it to be a grueling and miserable experience. But as a reference point, it is a good book to sort of flick through and find stuff to... that takes your interest, even though it's very, when you get into like the end section, so it's all like the noughties almost, it's very much like flavor of the week, such as like The King's Speech and Tootsie.
Mm.
That's a South African movie about the the street thug raising the baby.
Yeah, it's the sort of book, if I'm around someone's house and conversation is grim, or it's, I don't know.
You've got to read a book instead.
Well, I'm just thinking, I think about like at Christmas, you go around like the in-laws' place and you've got nothing to really do, but there's a copy of 1001 Films to Watch Before You Die, or any of those kind. You know, I've got 1001 computer games to play before you die.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think it's 1001. That sounds ridiculously high. And I sort of flick through that. 1001 song, you know, it's just a classic film series. But yes, this film, I'm just thinking that I think the thing is with Almodovar is that he's constantly got output. He's not Takashi Miike output, but every couple of years there is a new Almodovar film. And I guess what happens is that each film sucks up the oxygen of the previous ones, and I think you're right. I think Volver is still quite popular, but it's not. He's got those couple of classics, All About My Mother and Women Under the Edge of a Nervous Breakdown, and I guess maybe Talk to Her, because Talk to Her got like lots of award noms. That they're the ones that people probably go to, but then, yeah. I mean, what I'm hoping is you're going to go, I'll watch a few more, and then I haven't watched them all. Don't get me wrong, but he's just got such a constant back catalogue, and he'll do some dramas, and then there'll be some comedies, and then there'll be that weird The Skin I Live In, which is like a weird sort of psychological horror film, but it's not as well. Also, yeah, I think that would be one that I'd point you towards. But yes, I guess it's just because he's just got. Every 2 years, there's another one. I have a hard time keeping up. I watched Parallel Mothers the other day, and I know that there'll be another one coming out soon. I'll forget which one is which.
I don't think this is going to be our last visit to the work of Moldova, to say the least. I think Moldova's films are probably going to be much like Satoshi Kon's films over on our main show.
I would hope so.
As directors, we end up like covering the whole filmography over the course of of this show.
I mean, I'm glad to have introduced you to a film. I think I've made a good choice as a starter.
Oh, I certainly enjoyed this, and I think it's certainly going to rank very highly when it comes to like my film discoveries of this year. I think this is going to be one that sort of ranks very highly in that list.
But I think I can point you to a couple of others, and we'll do it maybe on other shows, where you'll see somewhat more complex stories, some more... You know, this film is very colourful and it's very well shot. There's lots of red everywhere, isn't it? It's a very visually striking, if not visually interesting, if that makes sense. Whereas I think I can point you at ones which, in terms of cinema, are a bit more interesting. So I think this has got the visuals, this has got the performances, but it's not as clever a film as something like Bad Education, which I had to watch twice to understand, but then it was well worth it. But it's cool. We'll get there. It'll be like you say, like Con or
Mikkei.
Well, we've done a few Mikkeis. I think Kim Ji Woon is probably somebody we've done more films than we realised. I think we've done four of his films, haven't we? So it'll be something like that, which kind of matches where it's sort of one of my favourite directors. Yeah.
My wife's observation in this film is that when they're moving the body, it's the most unrealistic body moving she's ever seen.
Yeah.
Which I have to agree, because it seems really light, that body.
Yeah. I think, again, it's not really... It's like, what's that Hitchcock film where there's the body that keeps turning up? And just, the trouble with Harry, you know, that's not really the point. Harry's the ultimate MacGuffin, isn't he? I think this dead body is just a reason to get characters together. But yeah, I know what your wife means.
Mrs. Jones has made her point.
she wins. Mrs. Jones wins the podcast this week.
So, she, as always, with the insightful commentary that she provides to my films, such as when we were watching Zodiac, and she decided the scene where he attacks the couple in broad daylight. And she decided to choose that moment to give me a lecture on how you would handle said situation. I'm like, Fincher's doing his best work here, and you want me to, like, go give me a lecture on how to handle if I got attacked by the Zodiac Killer in real life.
Oh, I hope you're taking notes and you have trial runs.
She's a true crime buff, my mother-in-law, so... so I get all these. I've yet to show her... Manhunter, is it Mindhunter, isn't it? The
Netflix show about
the Netflix show, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know, it's funny, I really enjoyed Mindhunter, except I think the second season's like 9 episodes long. It's weirdly curtailed. And I've stopped watching it 2 years ago, halfway through the final episode. So I've watched all of it apart from the second half of the final episode. Don't know why. But yes, you'll get a kick out of that if you like your serial killers.
I'm still stuck in season 2 of Stranger Things, so I know what you're on about.
I didn't get past episode 2 of Stranger Things, which is the oddest thing in the world, because you'd have thought they made it for me, but cannot get into that show at all. I don't think so. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And maybe I haven't made you a complete convert yet, but the fact that if I bring up another one, you're not going to... I don't think you're going to complain. So now it's just...
I'm certainly excited to see what he does, especially maybe look at some of his contributions to queer cinema in particular, as you said already, like things like Bad Education, or even like seeing like some Banderas in his native language would be really interesting as well. So obviously we've got Time Up, Time Down, which originally I would have thought was the film you were bringing when you mentioned you were doing Madhavar. But obviously And then you teased me and you said, by mentioning like Skinny Living, I was like, oh, that's on my watch list as well. And you're like, yeah, we're not doing that one. We're doing this.
I think the reason I didn't choose Skinny Living is because it's a little atypical of his work. And I had already covered it on my podcast. And I thought, that'd be cheating if I just keep bringing films that I've already covered. But then I still find ones that I hadn't seen. I found a few months ago, Broken Embraces, which I just found on Amazon Prime. Just popped up for some reason as a recommendation, even though I've never watched any one of our films on Amazon Prime. And I saw that, I thought that was really good. But yeah, there's a few. I think you'll get a kick out of Bad Education. I think, though, and it would be foolish not to watch All About My Mother, Live Flesh, and Women on the Edge of a Nervous Breakdown. I think there's some shit stuff as well, by the way. Or less good stuff. So let's not say it's all gold.
Well, on that note, it brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't already, please do check out our main show, the Asian Cinema Film Club, which obviously you will be finding the feed. You'll be finding this show on. And you can obviously check out our socials, which are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com, which will have the full archive of episodes, not only for this show, but obviously the AC Film Club as well, and also our bonus seasons as well, such as like Anthony Wong month, Takashi Miike month, and our chapter-by-chapter breakdown of Battle Royale. We also have some fun projects already in the works as well, so we're going to be slowly expanding our range of material that we're putting out. But as always, we love to hear your feedback on this show as much as our main show. So if there's a particular director or a country whose cinema you think we should be looking at, please do let us know in the comment section, or shoot us an email, acfilmclub@yahoo.com, or if just send it through our website, and we will certainly strive to try and work them into our globe-trotting adventures.
the Elwood and Stephen Podomatic universe we have extended to the world.
You say it like that, but in my mind, it's like the map on Street Fighter 2 with the little planes going across. it's like USSR. That's basically what it feels like. We're going from each episode. It's sort of like just the little plane traveling across the world map.
I like it. Like at Indiana Jones, yeah. That's the thing.
That would be a classier way. I'm just thinking,
I watched a film the other day. I can't remember what it was, but it was where that whole trope was invented. But never mind. Yes, I like the Street Fighter 2. That's equally as good.
We so travel what if it, by map, it's quicker.
So where are we getting on a plane to next time?
Next time, we are heading to France to look at the work of one of my favourite directors and a film that has been sitting on my watch list for many, many, many years. As next episode, we are going to be looking at Subway by Luc Besson, key figure in the cinema de look movement.
Do you know, that's interesting. Because I... on my podcast, I did a different Luc Besson film because I think you're right. I think Luc Besson is like sort of the modern French director, but also kind of exists in this strange world where he makes films which are Western as well. Things like what's the one with Natalie Portman? Where she's...
Oh, Leon.
Leon, yeah. Which is a Western film, isn't it? But it's also extraordinarily French. And but Subway is a film I've always wanted to watch and never got round to. Because that predates even Highlander, doesn't it? It's got Christophe Lambert in it.
Yep, get to see him in his native language. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Luc Besson will forever be associated with Jean Reno.
Yeah, for sure. And he did La Femme Nikita, didn't he?
He did, which I'm going to bring on a future episode. But as I said, Subway, for years I've been saying I'm going to watch Subway, and of course for years have failed to watch Subway. So we're going to finally watch.
I think that's for us both one of the most 80s looking films there is. So I'm really looking forward to that.
So that's obviously going to be on our next episode. But until then, thank you for listening. Thank you to my co-host, Stephen.
It's a pleasure as always.
And join us again for more globe-trotting cinematic adventures. But until then, good night.
Parpadeo de las luces que a lo lejos van marcando mi retorno. Son las mismas que alumbraron con su pálido reflejo juntas horas de dolor. Y aunque no quise el regreso, se vuelve al primer amor. La vieja calle donde le codijo, tuya es su vida, tuyo es su querer. Bajo el volón, mirar de las estrellas que con indiferencia hoy me ven volver.